And I am you.
And you are me.
It's just a crazy storm.
Hello and welcome to Action Packed, the travel podcast. I'm Peter.
And I'm Felice.
Together we've spent half a lifetime travelling to just about every corner of the world, making a living as travel writers out of what we like doing best.
And that's skiing, biking, beaches, hiking and a whole lot more.
Each week, Action Packed gives us the opportunity to share with you on the show some of these great experiences and the amazing people we meet along the way. Right now, real travel is limited to a daily walk around our local park, but the world will one day return to normal.
Meanwhile, dreams are risk-free and they're always available. You can find out more about us on our website, actionpacktravel.com. We'll regularly be posting links and show notes and loads of other useful stuff. If you like what you hear, please click on the subscribe button and listen to more episodes.
This week we're chatting to Konrad Bartolski, one of the golden greats of British skiing. His years as a racer and his highly professional midlife career as a passionate professional photographer. Welcome to the show, Konrad. Now, your life was supercharged in the space of 2 minutes, 7.52 seconds on the morning of December the 13th, 1981. That was the time it took you to complete the World Cup downhill course at Val Gardena in Italy. You took second place behind Austria's Erwin Resch, causing a French TV commentator to splutter to his audience, "Ce n'est pas possible, it's an Englishman." Incredibly, 39 years later, your performance that day remains the best result ever by a British alpine skier in a World Cup race. Although slalom specialist Dave Riding equaled it at Kitzbühel in 2017, no one has yet beaten it. Do you remember the moment?
It's one I won't forget, that's for sure. It'd been an awful lot of work had gone into the years before to get there. And it was something that, as a youngster, I used to lie in bed sort of dreaming of seeing that Union Jack raised on a podium. Unfortunately, it was only the second step, not the top step. I was always dreaming of the top step, but that was my fault anyway, because I made a mistake just in front of the finish line in Val Gardena, because I actually was leading the race until 100 metres from the finish when I mistimed the last jump and I lost 0.2 seconds. So instead of being a tenth of a second ahead, I was a tenth of a second behind. So world's fastest loser is what I became instead.
Why do you think your record's never been beaten? I mean, 39 years have slipped by. That's a long time.
It's because it's a very competitive sport. Alpine racing is hugely competitive. There's also huge sums of money invested by the Alpine nations. And so there's an awful lot of people vying and the competition is tight. I've really enjoyed watching Dave Riding the last years, skiing the way he skied, as I did enjoy watching Alan Baxter when he was skiing and when he legitimately won a bronze medal that was illegitimately taken away from him in 2002.
When did you first put on a pair of skis?
My ski sort of history started back in the war, because my father was escaped from Poland. He came over and he was a trainee pilot at the time, and they sent him out to Canada to be trained as a pilot. And there on their days off, he actually went to Banff and to Lake Louise, and that's where he fell in love with the mountains. And I even have colour films, 8mm films of his day trips to the Rockies. And when he came back from the war and everything settled down and he had a family, when my brother was 6 and I was 3, he said, "Right, I'm going to take you out to Kitzbühel we'll go skiing together." So the three of us went skiing, and that was my introduction to skiing. Can't say I did much distance in the first 6 days of skiing, because I was too young to go into ski school, so my father was taking me up and down the slope, and Gore-Tex and such had never been invented in those days. So I was getting pretty damp and mucky in the weather. Always said to my father, "Okay, look, can I go to the loo, please?" So I'd go into the loo in the hut, which is just at the bottom of the Kitzbühel downhill, amazingly. Lock myself in, because then I at least would have 20 minutes of warmth sitting on the loo, and my father banging on the door. Come on out.
When did you first take part in a ski race?
Yeah, well, that was still a long time away from when I first started skiing. I mean, that holiday became our family holiday. In those days, my father had 2 weeks holiday. He would take 1 week off to work on air safety conferences with a IFALPA, which is the International Federation of Airline Pilots Association, which he eventually became president. And the other week, he would share with us as a family, and we'd always go to Kitzbühel, basically just after New Year's, the first of quiet week after New Year's, which was one cheap, and it was easy for us to fly to Munich. And so I just learned to ski 6 days a year, really until I was 11. And then I had a second ski trip when it was the first time I ever skied anywhere else other than Kitzbühel. We went to Aviemore for a week skiing. Being fiercely patriotic, I wanted to ski in my own country. But racing happened because in Kitzbühel, being there in the beginning of January, the whole drama is building up. You walk around the centre of the beautiful town, and in the banks, you'll see all the trophies were there, and the ski instructor would be talking about it. They start to put the wicker fencing up the side of the mountain, and the preparation was happening. And
preparation for the Hahnenkamm, actually.
For the Hahnenkamm race. And this was this big, dramatic race that this was before the World Cup was sort of orchestrated in the way it was, but it was this huge race. And the story's even bigger than the race, I can assure you. The ski instructors would be just, tell me about this fellow who came down and hit this tree and bounced off this cliff. So I was being indoctrinated with the terror of this mountain, which probably played on my mind when I was racing down it a few decades later on. But the ski instructors always say, well, it's great. If the Austrians, the Swiss and the French suddenly thought, well, hold on, what about the British? Why can't we compete at this? And when I was about, I think it was 10, I persuaded my parents to let us stay a little bit longer so we could actually see the race. And I was standing beside the downhill, and the Aga Khan was racing down that year. He was racing for Great Britain. I watched all the races coming down, and an impressive spectacle it was. But then the Aga Khan came down about 10 or 15 seconds slower, and the ski instructor said, after the show, you bring on the clowns. I just thought, okay, right, I've got a job to do. And that was really the deciding moment. I mean, I was really enjoying my skiing and really from about the age of 8, inspired very much by a Warren Miller film we went to see in Kitzbühel, actually, because I went to see this film and I just suddenly realized this is what I wanted to do when I saw that film. And so I really enjoyed my skiing and had a fantastic ski instructor called Gitti Schatz, who introduced me to the love of the mountains and the beauty of the mountains. And from that point on, everything in my life really centered around skiing, I would say. And so the idea of ski racing was a challenge that I readily undertook. So obviously, how do you then start ski racing? Well, when my brother was 15, he had to do his O-levels and he couldn't take time out of school. So my parents sent him with a Dutch ski club because my father was working in Holland at the time. And he went then to Neustift for the Dutch Junior Championships. And he quite enjoyed that. And the following year, he decided to send me and my brother. And I would have been 12 then and he would have been, 15. So it was quite an exciting time for me. I had his ski boots, hand-me-down ski boots. They were almost too big for me to tie up with my laces. And in this giant slalom, I fell over at the last gate for the finish in my first race, which is fairly typical of me to get all the way down and blow it at the last corner. And then the next day, I was even more disappointed because this was an under-18s race. I was 12 years old at the time, and I came second. And it was my brother had beaten me, so I was really annoyed that my brother had beaten me in this race. That was sort of my introduction to it. Then that April, the British Junior Championships were being held in Scotland for the first time. And having skied in Scotland the year before, we were aware of it. So I thought, okay, well, I tried to persuade my parents to send me. And my brother did well in his O-level results. So they said, because because he'd done well, we'll send you off. And my grandfather drove us up from Leeds with a caravan towed out the back. He had this green painted caravan that he had at the bottom of the garden. And we drove up and parked that caravan at Glenmore Lodge, waxed the skis inside the caravan and lived inside the caravan, went down for fish and chips for dinner if we were lucky. We had a budget of £72 for the week between the three of us. The days we couldn't afford the lift passes, so we'd walk up and down the hills, which I absolutely hated.
Nevertheless, despite being just 12 years old, you came 10th in the slalom, and the nine lads ahead of you were all strapping 16 or 17-year-olds. So after that performance, you got a little bit of funding from the Kandahar Ski Club, and then in 1972, You raced at the Winter Olympics in Sapporo, Japan.
Yes, that I was 17, so that was then 5 years on from that point. I was trying to count out the number of days that I'd skied before I went to the Olympics. I reckon it was somewhere between 135 and 150 days I probably skied all my life before I made it to Sapporo.
That's a very small number.
But when we got there, I mean, it was actually a wonderful trip for a 17-year-old. And I was standing in Sapporo in this speed skating rink outdoors, beautiful sunny day. And, you know, it was quite an emotional moment for a 17-year-old boy, thinking of the millions of people watching on television, like I used to watch on television as a kid, all the Olympics and the Winter Olympic Games. I noticed that our team was one of the biggest there. Over the next couple of weeks, you know, I'd get down a course and officials would be at the bottom, "Oh, congratulations, well done, you finished." And I was sort of looking at them with a bit of a strange look. Surely we're supposed to be here competing, aren't we? Anyway, we didn't win one medal out of that huge team. So that spurred me on, and I came back from Sapporo saying, right, okay, I will never go back to the Olympics unless I can try and be competitive. And I went back, turned up at school, and I remember walking into a school having been away at the Olympics, and I just walked in, and I walked straight into my class, sat down, and the teacher threw a book and said, right, you've got a bit of work to do. There's no reference, no acknowledgement or anything. Imagine in this day and age with social media as it is, you know, somebody goes to the Olympics, they're all walking away. Absolutely nothing. Just straight back to work and get on with it.
Conrad, after you retired from competitive skiing, you went on to have a highly successful career as a journalist. At one stage, you also imported ski equipment from Austria into Britain. You worked in television. And then in recent years, a whole new career opened up for you as a professional photographer. When did this passion for photography begin?
Well, my passion for photography began as a youngster because my father used to, as I said, took films during the war. And so I had an interest in photography. He used to fly for KLM, and so he would fly to Tokyo, Japan, come back with all these brochures on cameras and such. And I remember working hard, painting the house, mowing the lawn to buy my first SLR camera when I was, I think, 14, 15 years old. Because I was always interested in photography. And when I was ski racing, I'd always take cameras with me. And we were privileged to go to Argentina, New Zealand, and various countries for training. And I used to take photographs of these beautiful countries I was visiting. And so that's how the passion evolved. And I would sell some of the pictures and write articles for one of the Austrian ski magazines, because that way it would help pay for the training that I was doing. So then when I retired from skiing and got involved in having a house, a mortgage and a family, then the photography waned a little bit. And then when digital cameras, the small ones, started to come out and they weren't too expensive, I remember buying one. And that's really what got me back into it. I was skiing with Graham Ostick one year in St. Anton and taking some nice pictures of him with his very small little Minolta Demirage X1, probably a quarter of a megabyte or something size sensor on it. It was minute, but it just meant that you could get things and do things. And Graham was building a lodge up in Norway, and by right on the top in Norway, on the side of the fjord, and that just caught my imagination. I thought it'd be great to go ski up there one time. And when the lodge was finished, got a group together, went skiing there, and I got not a huge camera, but a better camera, and took some pictures. And that's where really it all started. It was up in Lincoln Lodge.
Black and white, mainly black and white?
Well, it's... my exhibitions are predominantly black and white. I would say 95% black and white. I suppose the best lesson was I was in Iceland for a week, and it was the most remarkable week. I was with a good friend, John Faulkner, and other friends of mine, and Marco Shapiro was there. And most people know Iceland is a photographer's dream, and we had wonderful weather, wonderful snow, and everything was absolutely perfect. And I got back, and yeah, the pictures were nice, but they somehow just didn't, you know, they didn't really capture my emotions as I'd felt they were when I was out there. And after about 3 weeks, I was fiddling around on my computer doing some processing, and I started processing the Icelandic work in black and white, and suddenly I realized the value of taking out the color from a photograph, because often it's distracting. Blue skies are the most boring thing out in many ways. I mean, clouds are my best friend. And when you take away the colors, a lot of the time you actually increase the emotion and the passion and the detail and the memories of what you see. So yes, black and white is where I'll always lean to. Because again, photography is 40% is taking the picture. 40% of it is processing it and printing it. 10% is how you mount it and frame it. 10% is how you light it. And the printing process is of black and white is what's really fascinating. Because you start to see things that you never see on a digital screen. You see a texture and a richness and a depth that you would never see otherwise. It's what inspired Ansel Adams and sports photographers like Chris Smith, who was a great hero of mine when I was young. And you see then really what's special, because it's not what you see on Instagram. It's not what you see on a computer. It's what you see printed out on a fine art printed paper.
Last year you wrote, "We should never forget that we have inherited the great privilege to breathe and stand on this earth. When at the top of a mountain, where the oxygen is at its purest, I'm filled with a phenomenal clarity, an outstanding passion, and a real sense of purpose." So are mountains essentially your main or your only inspiration?
They're my main inspiration. Ironically, we're having this conversation when something's happened I never ever thought would happen, ever. I mean, it's totally unbelievable. The mountains have actually been locked down and switched off and cut off to human beings. It's illegal to be in the mountains in France, Austria, Switzerland, Italy especially. Could you ever believe something like that would happen? But that's where I get my passion, yes. Having said that, the passions come from the eyes. And something that I've been really evolving a philosophy over the last, it's probably this winter, is how narrow-visioned most of us are. And hopefully this hibernation time that we're all having to force to endure will allow us to look around ourselves a lot more, because most people really don't have any peripheral vision. They're really just so concentrated in looking ahead, more of this, more of that, you know, we've got to do this, we've got to do that. And our eyes are great for going left to right, moving around and seeing what's around us, behind us, and being more socially, visually aware of what's around us. Why do so many accidents happen on the slopes? Because people are looking straight forward, thinking about speeds, thinking about what they're about. They're not actually encompassing everything that's around them. They're not looking at the scenery. They're not enjoying the space that's around them. They're not evolving. So, yes, breathing in that fresh air and using your peripheral vision is something that is very easy to do when you're at the top of the mountain, but it's something that you can do anyway. You can do it if you're walking the back street of Jaipur. It's something you can do if you're in a along the beach in the Camargue, if you're on the nature reserve along the Camargue. You can do it anywhere. And that's what we need to get back to doing. And hopefully the benefit of this reset that we're all having in our lives now will enable that.
I agree. You've been on expeditions to all 7 continents. Do you have a favourite destination?
Yeah, the planet Earth is my favourite destination. And we have to look after it, that's for sure. So I suppose there's 2 places that really stand out for me. One is Argentina. I was training there in the mid-70s, and it was always, of all the places I've been in the world at that point, it was the one that I really wanted to go back to. And I went back there about 4 years ago, and that's the Andes there are pretty special. I mean, the Andes are just huge, enormous, wonderful, and the vivaciousness of the Argentinian people is pretty special. And another place I return to actually quite frequently is Japan. And Japan is, again, the manners, the culture there is extraordinary. And it's all based on nature, their art, their religion, their architecture, their way of life, all stems back down to nature. And they have this wonderful respect for nature. And I think that's something that every culture outside of Japan could take an awful lot of fruit from, because without nature, we are nothing.
You went, I think, in 2018 to King George Island in Antarctica. That was heli-skiing there?
Yes, we went heli-skiing down in Antarctica. It was the first time it's ever been done. And my heli-skiing amounted to a run probably of about 6 minutes. the helicopter had difficulty landing on top of the mountain because some winds had picked up. We just had to get down to the bottom again and fly back to base because there's no margin for error there. And, you know, I was curious about the idea of flying around in Antarctica in a helicopter, the impact on the environment. And a lot of people said, why are you doing that? Why are you going down? And the reason I went down was simply because I wanted to be able to photograph from the air. I had very limited time to do what I want to do from that perspective. So from a photographic point of view, it wasn't a huge result. But because of various issues we had with the whole itinerary, there's a lot of problems. Everything went wrong. I did get to see an awful lot, and it's staggering. We were staying at this Russian camp, and there's a diesel generator going there 24/7. Chug, 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 chug. Black smoke plume in the air. We went to look at some elephant seals, and it was quite a long hike, and it was a horizontal rain, and it was very cold and wet. And I asked our guide, said, is it all right to go for a, if you need to go to the toilet, is all right. He said, please do it in a bottle if you do it. I said, okay, fine. I can understand there being that particular about leaving waste. And then we're walking past the airport, it's a gravel landing strip to the base camp, and there's this generator going chug, 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 pouring all this bloody pollution into the air. So I was aware, but it's also very good that people get down to see the truth, because the truth is not something that is ever released too often to the general public. Unless people are able to get to see the truth, they can't tell people what the truth is, because certainly the people who are living down there never admit the fact that they've got diesel generator providing all the electricity.
You don't just photograph skiing and ski touring, things like that, do you? We've seen images of other sports and other travel, like India and fashion, or quite a mixture of things.
Yeah, I mean, we all have a camera with us now every day of our lives, pretty well. With not all, but nearly everyone has, because the pictures and images you can record on your iPhones or your telephones is quite extraordinary. In my last exhibition, I had a large print that was taken with my iPhone. And so the quality of what you can get is quite remarkable. And so even when I'm out hiking in the evenings, with this lockdown that we have at the moment, I still have a camera with me, and there are still images I'll capture and collect if there's something I see special. But I love working. I do some work with the National Youth Music Theatre. I love working with young kids when they're doing their dress rehearsals, because nothing's staged or organised, and you're working in very dark conditions, which technically is very challenging. Then the light can also be hugely dramatic. And so that's one of my favourite different locations I like working in. I do some occasional fashion shoots, but having a daughter who's in the fashion industry, with her business, Neva Noor, she's quite happy for me to come and help her out do her fashion shoots for her work. But that's something, again, that I do enjoy doing. It's a different setup and there are different requirements, and you have to have a consistency in your work with what you're doing there, because you might be taking 1,500 pictures in a day, and then you have to sort that down to 30 or 40, but you have to have a consistency so brochures look interesting but not full of shadows, they're not overly dramatic. So you have to work within certain restraints. I love, again, ballet. I did my first ballet, which is something, I love ballet, and I've always wanted to do. It's very difficult to get into the ballet. It's quite a closed shop environment to take photographs in. Fortunately, I knew somebody who could open the door for me, and that was something I really enjoy. So I enjoy capturing the moments. What I don't really like to do is set up and stage too much. I like to capture the moments and the emotions of people. And it's the surprise of things. You have a look at some photographs and, wow, it's incredible. And this is pictures of the Milky Ways and such. But there's probably about 30, 40 photographs gone into that. And that, to me, is a digital reconstruction rather than actually capturing what we see. You know, you're actually creating an untruth out of a truth. And what I like to do is to show the truth of what I see.
Where can people see and buy your work?
Well, I have a website, which is very simple. It's conradbartelski.photography. There's two sections to it. There's my exhibition work, which is limited edition prints, which are hand-curated and hand-printed up to order. And then if people are interested, these are large prints because the mountains are large and my work is large. ideal size I like working in is 6 foot by 4 foot size prints. And there's a challenge to get them the work to technically work that size. But the beauty is that you see things there that you'll never see in something smaller. And it does capture what the mountains are about, which are a large size space. But obviously there's limitations to how many people can put a 6 by 4 foot print up with a frame in their rooms. Certainly wouldn't fit in most people's loos where a lot of pictures hang these days. No, so the limited edition prints, that then if there's an interest in those, then you can mail me on that and I can send people the options. But then I have all my other work, which is the ski touring. I have a series of stock shots. They're all coloured. You can order those directly either as prints or as files. And those can be downloaded directly from the website.
And do you have any exhibition coming up?
Yes, I'm planning my next exhibition, which will be at Wimbledon Fine Art, which is in Church Road in Wimbledon. It'll be in November sometime. The date's still to be decided. Obviously, with what's going on at the moment, there's an awful lot of things up in the air, and I just hope that we'll have some sense of normality around that time of year. And looking forward to having further exhibition of my work then.
And do you think we have a ski season coming up for 2021?
I'm pretty sure that there will be a ski season next year. I'm sure there'll be some limitations what people can do and how they might go about things. It might be that you'll have to have a corona test before you're allowed to travel or something like that. There will be some very nervous areas. I mean, the Italians have been decimated by it, the Austrians, the Swiss, all the traveled people are really going to be struggling. It's such a knock in the teeth for them. However, humans are incredibly resilient and people bounce back. And I think one thing that people really do need after being hibernated like this is the mountains now more than ever.
Conrad, thank you very much for coming on the show. And we wish you the very best with your exhibition coming up. Details of where and when are in our show notes at actionpacktravel.com. And hopefully you and all of us will have a near normal and great ski season from this December.
Thank you, Peter and Felice. Very nice to speak to you.
That's all for now. If you've enjoyed the show, do please visit our website, actionpacktravel.com, or subscribe on Spotify, Google Podcasts, iTunes, or another of the many platforms that we're on. You can also find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with at least one other person.
And I am you.
And you are me.
It's just a crazy storm.